This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What happens when women take power? Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Newsweek's Fareed Zakaria says, one of the quiet, unreported tidal waves of the past decade is the rise of women in public life. These past few weeks have seen the first women heads of state in Africa and South America, and the first woman chancellor of Germany. Iraq's new parliament will be 25% female. Do women make a real difference? Do they have different priorities, different styles, different ways of achieving their goals? What about a woman president of the United States? That's To the Point. On Reporter's Notebook later on, child pornography and the Bush administration and internet privacy. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. Africa, South America, and Germany have elected their first women heads of state. Iraq's new parliament will be 25% female. On To the Point, as more women take part in public life, are they making a difference? Why is the U.S. so far behind? On Reporter's Notebook, Yahoo, Microsoft, and AOL say yes, Google says no. We'll hear about the latest flap over privacy on the Internet. First, this news update. It is official. The Shiite parties won 128 of 275 seats in Iraq's parliament, but that's 10 votes short of a majority. So a coalition will be needed to form the country's next government. Tim McGurk is reporting from Baghdad for Time magazine. Tim, thanks so much for being joining us. Who are the most likely coalition partners?
Well, I think it's probably almost certainly going to be the Kurds, because the religious Shiite parties, whom you said had 128 seats, the Kurds have got 53 seats. And both the Kurds and the Shiites are united on one thing, and that's that they want to have greater regional autonomy for themselves, which pretty much cuts the Sunni Arabs who are in the middle out of the deal.
What about Sunni representation, though? That certainly has been one of the major concerns, particularly with all the ethnic violence that's going on.
Well, I think, Warren, that's going to be the whole crux of what gets decided, and it could take weeks, maybe even months to decide this, because there's no way that the insurgency is going to stop unless the Sunni Arabs have some kind of say in the government that's going to take place here in Iraq.
Now, there was at the outset a promise to the Sunnis of a kind that they would be able to at least try to amend the Constitution to mitigate some of the problems that they have with this regional autonomy that you talked about. Are they going to get that opportunity?
Well, that's a good question, because you have the leader of the main Shia party, who's Abdulaziz Hakim, who's come out and says, well, no, we're not really ready to amend the Constitution, because that's what we agreed on before, and that's why people are Shiites and the Kurds are voting for us this time. So I think the only way that we're really going to find the Sunnis joining the government is if the American government starts putting very strong pressure on the Shiites and the Kurds to allow some significant Sunni Arabs into the government.
We're talking with Tim McGurk in Baghdad for Time magazine. In the meantime, what about the official results for some of the people we know about in this country? Ayad Alawi, for example, the secular Shiite who was, in fact, the prime minister for a while. How'd he do?
Well, he didn't do as well as he would have liked, but he did come away with 25 seats, so I think that could make him a pretty significant broker in whatever sort of deal goes down, because there's a chance that he may choose as a secularist to unite with the Sunni Arabs. And that would give them, I mean, not enough votes by any stretch of the means, but it would give them a much larger and more powerful bloc to deal with the Shia and the Kurds.
What about Ahmed Chalabi, the man who the Pentagon thought at the outset might well become the next leader of Iraq?
Well, that's right. I think the Pentagon put all of their chips behind Chalabi. And what we've seen from these elections is that his party got exactly zero seats inside the new Iraqi parliament. So he's pretty much of a flop this time around.
So what kind of power does the American government have at this point to try to influence the religious Shiites and the Kurds to include the Sunnis in a way that might, in fact, help to mitigate the insurgency?
Well, I'm not quite sure what sort of power they really do have. I mean, they do have, I mean, the U.S. ambassador here, Zalmay Khalilzad, is a very able wheeler-dealer, and he's been good at trying to convince the Kurds and the Shia to bring the Sunnis along. And I'm sure that he will offer them some sort of sweetener if they will broaden their cabinet to include the Sunni Arabs. But nobody's saying exactly what the U.S. government would be prepared to do to get that sort of compromise.
Well, thanks for the political update. I think everybody wants to know the status of Jill Carroll, the freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, who was kidnapped. This is the deadline, as I understand it, for the release of women prisoners, according to her captors, who have threatened to kill her. What do you know about that at the moment?
Well, I mean, as you said, Warren, I mean, the deadline is supposed to be tonight, but there does seem to be a lot of very important people who have come out, Sunni politicians with links to the insurgent groups. We even spoke to some insurgents today who said that they're very much opposed to the kidnapping of the freelance journalist. And I think that it's turning into the sort of issue that would put enough pressure on the kidnappers. And nobody really knows who they are. But we do know that pressure is kind of rounding on them from all sides to release her.
So nobody seems to be supportive of her abduction then?
No, and that's a good thing, and it's quite groundbreaking because in the past cases of kidnappings there, there hasn't been this widespread condemnation that we're seeing with Jill Carroll's kidnapping.
All right. Of course, we all hope for the best with that. Tim McGurk in Baghdad for Time. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, what happens when women take power? That's To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. In 1990, Mary Robinson became the first woman president of Ireland. For the next 7 years, she increased the profile of an office with limited powers. In 1997, she was chosen to be the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. She used that bureaucratic position to become a public advocate for the human rights agenda worldwide. Madam President, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be with you.
Well, we're very happy to have you. I understand you're on a cell phone at the United Nations. Let our listeners know that the transmission isn't perfect, but it's good enough. When you were head of state, did it matter, or how did it matter, perhaps I should say, that you were a woman? What difference did it make?
I think it mattered enormously in the Ireland of December 1990. It was so much of a breakthrough. Not just that I was a woman, but I was a woman with a track record of having worked to open up the modern Ireland, link with the Irish diaspora abroad. I had taken cases on issues of family planning, the status of children born out of marriage, and the role of women generally, the constitutional issues. And I had never been in either of the main political parties. I was nominated by the smallest party, the Labour Party. So it wasn't just that I was the first woman elected. I was the total change around. And it somehow signaled a modern, more progressive linking also with Northern Ireland, because I had made that a big issue in the election, to reach out the hand of friendship to both communities in Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic.
If it was a modern and progressive record, was it also a feminist record that you had?
Yes, and I defined feminism in an Irish way, which is actually very inclusive. I reached out very much as president to the women who would rather defensively say, oh, don't bother about me, I'm just a housewife. And I would say, no, you're not. There's no question of don't bother. You actually, let's think about what you're doing. You're not only homemaking, you're probably also involved in your community. And then she'd say, yes, I'm running the club for young people, or I'm running an old people's home, or I'm doing Meals on Wheels. And I would encourage these women to say, your contribution is just as important as anyone else in the locality. So I was and am feminist in the sense of really promoting the women's energies and vision and way of doing as being a huge contribution at all levels of leadership.
You weren't really talking then about changing women's roles per se. You were saying that you didn't make a distinction between housewives and women in careers, for example, in any invidious way.
Well, what I was doing was actually very ambitious, and it still is, that it's not just up to women to change the barriers that make it difficult for women to get to the top of business or the media or the political sphere. Those barriers are barriers usually in relation to child rearing and homemaking, and they have to do with the hours of work. And that's not just an issue for women, it's also an issue for men, for fathers. What I would like to see is more fathers joining with mothers to say parenting in those vital years of our lives, and we need the workplace to be more adaptive rather than us having to contort ourselves and have less time for the precious family life. And that's not pie in the sky, and that's about actually wanting flexi time, wanting to be able to share jobs, wanting the workplace to adapt more to the parenting role of couples so that there is better equality in decision making.
We're talking with Mary Robinson, who was formerly president of Ireland, the first woman to be president of Ireland. She's talking to us now from the United Nations on a cell phone. We're getting a few breaks in your transmission, Mary Robinson, but so far I don't think the intent of your comments has been lost in any way. Tell us a bit about your role as High Commissioner for Human Rights. You were the first person in that job to visit Tibet. You were critical of the United States for the use of the death penalty. Were you in that job? Was it also important that you were a woman?
I think it was. I was the second High Commissioner, a very young office with a very important mandate of leadership in human rights, and being able to go to where there were victims of violations. And, of course, many of the victims of violations of human rights are women and children. The whole area of trafficking, for example, the violence against women and children, the need to strengthen property laws to empower women economically. So I was aware that I brought a lot of strengths, and I brought the experience of 7 years having been a head of state. So I had a lot of confidence. And that's why when I was going to China on my first visit, I insisted on going to Tibet. They didn't want me to go, but I said, well, I'm not coming unless I can go. And it also meant that it was important for me to be able to address violations by countries or lack of holding standards, no matter what country, even if a country was regarded as having been a leader in human rights. The United States has a wonderful legacy of leadership. Eleanor Roosevelt was the first chair of the Commission on Human Rights, another wonderful woman. And at the same time, when we had the problems of Guantanamo Bay, the lack of clarifying status under the Geneva Conventions, the overuse of immigration law to sweep up a lot of people and even deport them without due process, and that in different ways the United States wasn't upholding the high standards it had set itself. It was my job to call attention to that and to know that it was actually having a bad example effect elsewhere in the world.
Can you generalize about women in power? Do they rule differently from men? Do they have different styles, different policy priorities?
I think that's a very interesting question. And the answer is a bit complex because it is some do and some don't. If you take a very powerful woman whom we all recollect when we talk about women leaders, Margaret Thatcher, Lady Thatcher, she ruled more in tradition of a male prime minister. I mean, she was a woman, and she used some of her qualities as a woman who was determined to get her way. But by and large, she didn't support other women. And then you have a number of women leaders, including current women leaders like Helen Clark in New Zealand and many others. In fact, the majority now, I would say, are very supportive of other women, and I certainly was part of that. It's just a different way of doing it. And women almost know instinctively whether a woman leader elected is going to be supportive of other women or use her skills to be more in line with exercising power in a more male way.
There is a perception, according to polls worldwide, that women are perceived as being less corrupt than men. Is there any factual basis for that, do you think?
I'm not sure we have enough women leaders yet to be truly able to say that is true. I wish it was true, and I do think that women who get to positions of power have had a very hard road to get there. So they're very purposeful. That's certainly true. I mean, at the moment, we have 11 top women leaders in our world, and we have so, celebrated the wonderful election of Africa's new leader, President Sirleaf, and I followed her inauguration. I have met her in the past. She's a very committed woman and a first for Africa of a directly elected woman. I haven't yet met President-elect Bachelet of Chile, but again, it's wonderful that a woman of her background who is opening up the boundaries of power, I think, in her country, that she is elected. I know President Tarja Halonen very well, the current president of Finland, who is going to be re-elected. She almost got re-elected on the first count. She certainly will by present predictions on the second one. And she's been giving very good leadership in Finland and in Europe as a whole, in the EU. And she has, for example, reached out to the Roma people in Europe as a woman president of a very successful knowledge-based economy that's doing very well. She's reaching out to the most vulnerable. I'm very struck by how Chancellor Merkel, elected, looks so confident, much more so than beforehand, and I really wish her well in her ministry. I mentioned Helen Clark already, a long-standing Prime Minister of New Zealand who was re-elected recently, and again, who is a good friend. And of course, I was delighted to be followed in my own presidency by President Mary McAleese, who is now in her second term, her second seven-year term as President of Ireland. And we both joke that small boys in Ireland weep on their mother's knee and say, why can't I grow up to be president? And I know about these people very intimately because I have actually got a role as chair of the Council of Women World Leaders, which is an informal club of elected women presidents and prime ministers, both former and current. And there are more than 30. In fact, we're up to about 36 now with the recent members, if they join, which I hope they will. And it's making women's leadership visible. And it's to answer your question is to say, yes, women do bring different strengths, a networking strength, insights, a practicality, and in more than anything else, I think, a purposefulness because it's been so hard to get there.
Do you think that the world would be a more peaceful place if there were more women heads of state?
Well, again, it's hard to say. Women have made war. recent women leaders, Lady Thatcher, the head of Israel, we know that it doesn't necessarily mean. But I do think it's better for humanity that women are represented as well as men at the highest levels of power and of business and of media and of the trade union movement because we bring complementary qualities and insights. And I think I was very fortunate that part of what I felt in being elected President of Ireland was it was a strength to be a woman. In serving as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, what a strength it was to be a woman because I understood violence. I understood vulnerability. I think what I'm really saying is it's not just that it's better for a woman and women generally. It's better for humanity as a whole to have as good a balance as we can have.
Well, Mary Robinson, it is a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you, and thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Again, the former president of Ireland, first woman to hold that position, also first woman to be UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking to us today from the United Nations, once again by a cell phone. She referred to the two women who have become president conspicuously just in the past couple of days, the first woman president in Africa, the first woman president in South America. We also have, of course, the first woman chancellor of Germany, whom she mentioned as well, Angela Merkel. Lois Hecht Oppenheim is a professor of political science at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles. She specializes in Latin America and South American studies. She's taught at the University of Chile, and she was in Chile during the when the vote came in, and Michelle Bachelet, or Bachelet, depending on your preference, was elected. Ms. Oppenheim, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us a bit about what happened in Chile. Like Ireland, a patriarchal Catholic country, here's a single mother who appears to be, as Mary Robinson was in Ireland, very different from what we've seen before.
Yes. Bachelet is, in fact, a very unusual person. She's not like the traditional politicians in Chile at all. In addition, as you said, to her being a single mother, she's a feminist, she's an agnostic. She, I think, epitomizes, and I think this is, was her appeal, really, that she epitomized something different from the normal politics in Chile. And there was something in the atmosphere in Chile that kind of created an opening for someone like her to be elected.
What's that atmosphere, and is it prevalent anywhere else?
Well, I think the atmosphere was particular to Chile. There were a couple of things. First, she's part of a ruling center-left coalition called the Concertación that's been in power since the end of military rule in Chile in 1990. And their popularity in elections had been going down since 1997. So there was some question as to whether they could really sustain election victory as a with a fourth presidency. There had also been a series of scandals that had affected politicians, both government politicians and the right-wing opposition. So there was a sense that there was growing corruption. People were kind of tired of that. And there were a lot of politicians who had come back to office after the end of military dictatorship. So they were kind of like old political faces that came back in 1990 who were still there in 2005. And I think people were ready for something different. And so she represents, she presented herself really as someone who was different from the normal politics. She's not a kind of a lifelong politician. She was active in her political party, the Socialist Party, but she wasn't really a politician. She didn't hold any political office until 2000 when she was made Minister of Health under President Lagos and then became Minister of Defense. And she also is a very open, forthright person. She jokes about herself. When she was Minister of Health, she used to joke and say, you know, I'm overweight and I have high blood pressure. You know, she would say things that normal politicians might not say. And
well, let me, on that very theme, let me ask you this. Mary Robinson said a moment ago that it was extraordinarily important that she was a woman when she was president of Ireland and when she was a commissioner, high commissioner on human rights as well. Do you think it will be important for Chile that Bachelet is a woman as well?
Yes, I think it's going to be very important for Chile. She's been very self-conscious about that and said that, you know, it's not only what she wants to do, but how she does things. And I think as a woman, she brings this idea of being more open, being more accessible, being a candidate of the people. She came from, she became the nominee and the president in part because of popularity in opinion polls that kind of propelled her to such visibility.
I'm going to interrupt you for the moment, Lois Hecht Oppenheim. We will come back to you and talk with others as well about women in power, that being one of the great untold stories, as we have recently been hearing, developing over the past few years. On Reporter's Notebook, Child Pornography, the Bush Administration, and Internet Privacy. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. A moment ago, I tried to paraphrase Fareed Zakaria in Newsweek magazine. Let me simply read a quote from one of his recent columns. One of the quiet, unreported tidal waves of the past decade is the rise of women in public life. And that's what we're talking about today on To the Point. Lois Hecht Oppenheim, again, professor of political science at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles, talked a moment ago about the new president of Chile. Now let's turn to Liberia and Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. Leaf, I know this is not your specialty, but in what way do you think it's important in Africa that for the first time a woman is head of state?
I think it's extremely important in Africa, just as it is for Latin America. One of the things that I think both of these women have in common, which I think is important in both cases, is that they represent figures of reconciliation. Both in Liberia coming out of a period of civil war and in Chile still having a lot of conflict over the period of military rule that was so brutal in Chile, both of these women represent the sense that you can, in fact, bring warring groups together and have a society where there's reconciliation and caring for each other.
On the other hand, as Mary Robinson just pointed out, women who have been heads of state have made war. Margaret Thatcher was one. Golda Meir in Israel was another. Is there anything about women leaders that would lead you to contend that the world would be more peaceful, or that more people would reconcile if there were more women leaders?
Well, I do agree with Mary Robinson that it's a complex question, and there are some women, such as Margaret Thatcher and Golda Meir, who obviously were more in a male mode of operating. But there's been a lot of discussion about a different way of doing politics, and I think certainly in the case of Bachelet, she has presented herself as someone and has said forthrightly that the way she's going to rule is different than the way men have ruled in the past. And to give one example, she has made it a priority to have gender parity in her cabinet. There are going to be equal number of women and men in the cabinet and new faces. So I think that if a woman comes to power who is self-conscious about being a woman and being a feminist, yes, she can have a different kind of politics.
Lois Hecht Oppenheim, again, professor of political science, University of Judaism, Los Angeles. Marjorie Margolis is a former Democratic Congress member from the Philadelphia area, served one term, 2 years, 1993 to 1995. She's author of the book A Woman's Place, Freshman Women, Who Changed the Face of Congress. She's also professor of politics at the Fells Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Margolis, welcome to you.
Well, hello.
Is the United States, which has not had a woman president, behind the curve?
You noticed. I think we're ready to. I think that there's more conversation, there's more movement, there's more, the recognition that we're primed and we're ready, and shame on us if we feel uncomfortable having a woman at the top of the ticket.
Why do we feel uncomfortable, do you think?
I just believe we still, as Homo sapiens here in the United States, feel comfortable walking into the voting booth and voting for a white male. One of the topics that we covered, obviously, in this book that I wrote, when there were 24 new women who came in 1992, there were 24 who won from the 102nd Congress. But we doubled the number of women in Congress for the first time. And if we continue to be elected at that rate, we will be equally represented in 451 years. There's something about us that says that the white male should be in power. But I think we're changing that. And I think I think we're changing it more geometrically than exponentially. But I think we're looking at it through a different prism now, thank goodness.
What has been the role of the feminist movement in the United States that has led people to feel either better or worse about having women political leaders?
Well, I give the feminist movement a lot of credit for moving the dialogue, for continuing the conversation. I do this Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, and I talk at schools, a lot of them in the South, where if you walk into the classroom and say, okay, how many of you think you're feminists? No one will raise her hand. And if you then explain over the course of the time that I'm there what a feminist really is and what a feminist should be, and I mean equal rights and equal pay and equal education, all those kinds of things, then everyone seems to shift. And I think that feminism has been marginalized and has been made ugly, and it shouldn't be. Feminists have done a heck of a lot to make sure that we move the conversation. And I don't mind here. I was just on a program with someone who has written a book called, you know, How Women Have Made It Worse. I don't mind that kind of conversation because, first of all, I think it's an old conversation, an ancient one, as a matter of fact. But I do think it moves us ahead. I think that there, I think most of us are in the same center. Most of us are in the moderate middle. We want to get things done. We've managed to raise families and to continue to work. We couldn't do it all at the same level at the same time, but we did it. And that's where we want to be.
Kate O'Byrne, I think, is the author you were referring to, who wrote the book you mentioned. Again, Marjorie Margolis, former Democratic congressman, now professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Let me go back to our other professor, Lois Hecht Oppenheim, at the University of Judaism. How would you compare the situation in Chile with the situation in the United States as far as the possibility of a woman becoming a head of state are concerned?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think there are a number of obstacles in the United States that perhaps didn't exist in Chile because Chile is such a smaller country. And, you know, we have a much more complex way of getting a nomination, which involves substantial amounts of fundraising to run in primaries all across the United States. That's different from what happened in Chile, where actually traditionally the decision was made behind closed doors by party elites. And this time, as I said, given the circumstances in Chile, the political atmosphere, Bachelet really won the nomination because of opinion polls, because she was so popular that the coalition decided to go with her.
Well, do you agree with Marjorie Margolis that the United States is ready for a woman head of state?
I hope she's right. I guess I'm a little less hopeful than she, but maybe. We certainly are behind the curve when we look around the world.
Let me bring a man, or I should say another man, into this conversation. John O'Sullivan is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. That's a conservative think tank in Washington. Formerly, he was special advisor to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, also assisted her with writing her memoirs. He's been in the United States for a long time. And John O'Sullivan, good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be here again.
What do you say to the possibility at this point that a woman might be elected president of the United States? And would it be a woman, if do you think, like Margaret Thatcher, or a woman like Mary Robinson?
Well, I mean, I don't know who it's going to be, obviously. I will say that once it's happened, it won't seem to be a big deal. Once Mrs. Thatcher became leader of the Conservative Party, it didn't seem to be a big deal. Once she became Prime Minister, the same thing. It's a totemic thing. Once it's happened, the big significance has gone. Now, what kind of leader? I would say myself that it would be easier for a Conservative woman to be elected than for a Liberal woman, for this reason, that an innovation, a radical innovation, which some people apparently think a woman would be, is easier to take if it's surrounded by a comforting aura of stability, no great revolution, and consequently someone like Margaret Thatcher in this country, in Britain, or let's say someone in this country like Carla Hills, who was a cabinet minister in first George Bush's administration. They'd find it easier, I think, to be elected than somebody who is associated with innovation, radical ideas, like Hillary Clinton.
What was it like to work for Margaret Thatcher?
Oh, she was an extremely thoughtful, considerate, and kind boss. You will find if you check, everybody who worked for her said that. Now, she was very, very tough, but she was tough with her equals. She was tough with other ministers who have, as you know, a kind of semi-independent position in British politics. And she drove them very hard, and rightly so. But with the people who worked around her, she couldn't have been more decent. I will say one thing, by the way, that I think it's a mistake to think that women leaders bring some kind of special healing or reconciliation quality to politics. It wasn't true, for example, of Mrs. Gandhi in India, who seized power and wielded it unconstitutionally. And in the case of the new Chilean president, she is not the agent of reconciliation. She is the result of reconciliation. It's the previous two presidents who've really brought about the reconciliation of that society with its past.
Mary Robinson, the first president of Ireland, whom we had on a moment ago before you came aboard, said that she thought Lady Thatcher ruled in the male tradition and that she wasn't particularly supportive of other women politicians. Is that a fair comment?
No, it's not. For a start, there is no such thing as a male way of ruling or a female way of ruling, as has become clear in virtually every case in which a woman has held power. They act like politicians, like people entrusted with responsibility for difficult decisions. And there's no female way of deciding whether or not you have to deal with the seizure of the Falklands or the fact that the budget deficit it is rising too rapidly. There's simply a right way and a wrong way. As regards, so I would say that it's wrong to think in those terms. And
gender, you're saying per se, doesn't make a difference.
No, I mean the circumstances that you inherit make a difference. The constitutional mechanisms make a difference, and women actually don't act that differently from men in the circumstances. What makes the difference is the kind of politics that they believe in. Much more a question of left or right than male or female.
John O'Sullivan at the Hudson Institute, a conservative think tank, former advisor to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Back to Marjorie Margolis again. Our former Democratic congresswoman, whom we talked to a moment ago. Let me ask you about the distinction that John O'Sullivan made between Hillary Clinton, whom he described as somebody who would be an apostle of radical change, and a more conservative woman. He says the more conservative one would be the more likely to be elected here in the United States the first time around, presuming that after that it's no big deal. What do you say
right.
to that?
Well, I mean, it's the Nixon going to China feeling. And to a certain extent, I think he's right. But I do think some of the things that have been said show that a lot of it is about personality base. A lot of it has to do with presentation. With Bachelet, it was said that she didn't take herself too seriously. You find that women really do sometimes present, and the criticism with women is, oh, she takes herself so seriously. Women who kind of rise above that, Ann Richards, go really far. And
Ann Richards, the former governor of Texas, one of the funniest politicians ever to make a speech in the United States.
She was a riot. I mean, that same year, Carla Hill, who has just been mentioned, made a speech in front of the convention. And if you play them together, you see Carla Hill did a wonderful job. But Ann Richards knocked the cover off the ball. That is what we have to kind of look at as women when we're talking about. We did a training on Women's Campaign International in Bosnia, and many of the questions were asked a woman stood up and she said, I think that it's very clear that in this room, because there were all different ethnic groups represented, and she stood up, she said, somebody in this room, it's very possible that your husband killed my husband. It's very possible that one of your relatives killed my relative. But if we don't stand up here as women and say we don't want our children to die, this war will never end. It is their ability to have a different conversation. Having said that, when we were in Romania, one of the reporters said to us, you know, we'll never have a woman in charge. We tried Elena Ceaușescu, and she was a disaster. And we asked him, well, what about Nicolae? Are you going to then reject all the men? It's very difficult for women to start at the beginning, because when the pedestal, when they're put on the pedestal, it's very difficult for them to stay there. It becomes wobbly much more easily. In other words, we're considered outsiders. When we get there and we start to lead the same way some of the men do, then people will say very quickly, well, they're just the same as the other guys.
Well, so do you agree then with what John O'Sullivan just said, that it's really a question of right and wrong, not male and female, that gender per se doesn't really make any difference?
I think gender does make a difference, but I think it's in the personality of the person. And I think that in some cases women come to the table a little bit more, sometimes they get more coverage. Sometimes it's tougher for women because other women don't feel as comfortable voting for them. So
you argue in your book, A Woman's Place, Freshman Women Who Changed the Face of Congress, that in fact there were bills, family-oriented bills in particular, that passed because women were in Congress?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we have to stress here with regard to representation, not necessarily the heads of state, is critical mass. As soon as we get enough people there who want to put some of these issues on the front burner, these back burner issues, family and medical leave never would have passed had we not gotten there.
Okay, let me go back to John O'Sullivan on that one. Do you think then that even though one woman might or might not rule differently from the way a man would, that this critical mass issue is important, and that the number of women who are in fact in representative bodies, for example, rather than executive bodies, might really make a difference?
I think what where I think the importance of this comes in, the critical mass comes in, is that once you have a substantial number of women in the legislature, then, and particularly when on both sides, then I think certain kind of issues which we think of as gender issues cease to be gender issues. They become simply issues, with women saying something on one side and the opposite on the other. That, I think, is it. Now, women actually, to some degree, benefit, oddly, or not women, but feminists benefit to some degree from the fact that when, let us say, the left party has most of the women in parliament, they're able to present feminist views as being the views of all women. And if there isn't a substantial number of conservative women on the other side arguing against those things, then those issues tend to be regarded as women's issues, and they speak with special authority on them, they get through. Once you have a substantially equal representation on both sides of the, so to speak, ideological aisle of women, then in those circumstances, I think, curiously, feminists lose some influence, because you have women like Cato Byrne, who are able to make a very strong case for what is a conservative view of women's issues rather than the accepted liberal, okay, what has been till they've been accepted as the liberal view.
Back to Alois Hecht Oppenheim, our professor at the University of Judaism in Los Angeles. Your take on that point?
On whether women will be different?
Yeah.
Yes.
And the critical mass issue, and whether or not feminism itself then becomes a very different matter when there are more women in a particular legislative body.
Yes. First of all, I think that women can, in fact, make a difference and can be different. They're not always different, but they can be. And I think critical mass is an important issue because there are ideas that are not part of the mainstream that don't get into the legislature or even in general political dialogue and the agenda until there are enough women there to get heard. So I think that critical mass is important, and I thought it was rather interesting to hear the term, somehow these become issues, they're no longer gender issues. They become issues instead of just gender issues because enough women are bringing them to the political agenda, to the table. And without their presence, they're not heard.
Got it. John O'Sullivan, back to you. You mentioned Cato Byrne, said she makes a very strong argument. The title of her book is Women Who Make the World Worse. Do you buy that title? Do women make the world worse?
Well, she's not saying women make the world worse. She's referring to particular women and to particular feminists. And that's my point, that in a sense, if women are only on one side, let's take the issue of abortion. This is a good example. That's, the right to an abortion is thought of as a woman's issue. In fact, if you look at the opinion polls, women are slightly more than men likely to oppose that to the abortion right, likely to favor restrictions on it more than men do. Now, once you have a substantial representation of women on both sides of the argument, that the right to an abortion ceases to be, quote, a woman's issue, and becomes simply an issue of,
okay,
which you have men and women on both sides.
Let me go back and get Marjorie Margolis to respond to that. You brought up this question of critical mass. What about that?
Well, it completely depends on how the question is asked. If you ask women if women should have the choice, and which is kind of a Republican view, not a Democratic view, a Democrat view, if you ask them, should government stay out of your bedroom, should government be less involved, there's an astonishing number of women who say, yes, women should have the right. Women should have the choice. Now, should it be absolute? No. There is this enormous sane center, this moderate middle that says abortion should be rare, safe, and legal, depending how the question is asked.
Okay. Very interesting conversation with all of you. We have run out of time, and not surprising that we ended with the particular issue that we did, talking about the consequences of women in power. Marjorie Margolis, her book, A Woman's Place, Freshman Women Who Changed the Face of Congress. John O'Sullivan at the Hudson Institute, former advisor to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Lois Hecht Oppenheim, a political science professor, University of Judaism, Los Angeles. And our earlier guest, Mary Robinson, first president of Ireland, first woman president of Ireland, and first woman to become UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Thanks so much to all of you for being with us today. The Bush Justice Department has asked internet search engines for massive amounts of data to find out what consumers are looking for when they go online. The government says it's nothing personal, just an effort to study child pornography. Google says it's worried about its customers' privacy. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Yahoo, Microsoft, and AOL have all complied with the government's request for 1 million web addresses visited by their customers over a one-week period, chosen randomly. But Google says it won't go along because its customers might think it was willing to reveal information about who they are and what they've been looking for. Now the Justice Department has gone to court in San Jose, California to force the issue. John Morris is staff counsel for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
What about the government's contention that it is not, in fact, looking to find out who went where, but rather it has this more general research objective? Is that legitimate?
Well, I mean, I think that's an accurate statement of what is happening right in this particular instance. In this case, the government is not really trying to find out what you or what I found on Google. And Google is asserting, and I think with good cause, that even the sanitized version of its searches could compromise privacy. And I think Google has a very legitimate concern beyond the privacy concern that it did not spend billions of dollars to become the free research device for litigants in civil litigation. Warren, if I could, let me just correct something.
Absolutely.
To make very clear that the case that underlies this subpoena has absolutely nothing to do with child pornography. The lawsuit relates to a law that tries to regulate and restrict access to completely legal content that is legal for adults to get access to. The law does not relate to either obscenity or child pornography, both of which are illegal. I think it's just in terms of the rhetoric of the debate about Google, it's important to just note that this is not about illegal content. It's about content that is legal.
I certainly understand that point, but hasn't the government made reference to child pornography in its arguments about it?
I don't believe so. I've read
okay.
their papers, and I don't believe
all right.
they have.
I either misread articles then, or they have been misreporting, and I want to thank you for making the point.
Yeah, it's certainly some of the rhetoric around this is it always gets to child pornography and obscenity when, in fact, often it doesn't really relate to those two topics.
Well, what about the possible abuses involved? If, in fact, all of these search engines do what they're asked and Google is required to go along by the court, what does that do that you have a problem with?
Well, I mean, I'm very concerned just as to really set the precedent that one can go to Google or to any of the search engines and retrieve information about search data. I mean, just to give you an example, if I was a government trying to investigate who leaked information about NSA spying, I would be very interested in searches that people might have made because I would be willing to wager that the New York Times reporters who broke that story did Google searches on their informants. You know, if Joe Smith calls you up from the NSA and says, I want to tell you about some illegal spying that's going on, I'll bet you the reporter types in Joe Smith and NSA. And that would be information that Google would be producing. And so, I mean, there's an example that this information could be misused in some context.
Administrations, as I understand it, going back to and including the Clinton administration, have maintained that the government ought to have this right, certainly for national security purposes. What do you say to that? Does that change the argument?
Well, let me ask you, the government should have the right to do what
to,
exactly?
To get the kind of information that we're talking about. What website did John Smith go to? When did he do it?
Well, if in fact this relates to a criminal investigation or a national security investigation and there is sufficient evidence to establish probable cause and a court decides that, yes, in fact, surveillance of John Smith is appropriate, then that's fine. And I believe that companies like Google and AOL and Microsoft comply with that type of interception order or mm-hmm. surveillance order all the time. It's a fairly common thing. But the case that Google is contesting now is not a situation where some crime has been committed. Essentially, the government is, in this case, trying to get Google to do some research that the government really could do on its own. I mean, there are other ways that the government could make its case in the civil litigation.
Understand the point. Now, John Morris, again, staff counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. I just want to read one paragraph or one sentence from a report on the Associated Press out of San Jose, saying this: the government contends it needs the data to determine how often pornography shows up in online searches as part of an effort to revive an Internet child protection law that was struck down 2 years ago by the U.S. Supreme Court on free speech grounds. You're contending that AP is wrong?
No, AP has referenced pornography, but not child pornography and not obscenity. And pornography is a more generic term relating to content that it's legal for adults to access sexual content. I mean, a lot of people don't like the fact that the content is available, but in our country, accessing Playboy magazine is legal. But most people would call that content pornography. So
well, certainly
that
not really... Playboy magazine claims that's not what it is.
Well, Playboy might, yes, but more specific adult.
All right. On the free research question, there is certainly one to be asked. We don't really have time to go into it today, but that is, why do Google and the other search engines keep this information? Should they guard their customers' privacy by not doing that? John Morris, we have about 20 seconds left, if you can give us a quick answer.
I think you've asked a very critical question, and although Google is generally pretty good on privacy issues, we do think that Google and the other search engines need to reevaluate their retention of this kind of information.
All right. We're going to take this up again on our next program. John Morris, thanks again for being with us.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Staff counsel, Center for Democracy and Technology. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Jonah King, Christian Bordahl, Sherman Rimbaugh, managing producer Karen Ranziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Thanks for joining us, and do it again. To the Point, produced live, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.